many years, Islamic scholars, some Islamic political parties, movements, and groups in Islamic countries have spoken about Islamic governance and political system. Some even claim to have established such a system, presenting it as the best form of government. These trends and claims range from the Muslim Brotherhood movement in Egypt to the Islamic Republic regime in Iran, the Taliban in Afghanistan, and various extremist groups across Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. They argue that an Islamic system of governance can provide a more effective social, economic, political, and cultural framework for human societies. These groups often criticize democracy and human rights, rejecting pluralism, civil liberties, and equal citizenship rights. The foundations of these ideas were introduced within the framework of Islamic political jurisprudence by certain Islamic scholars in the 6th century AH. In today's podcast of the World Anti-Extremism Network, I, Rajab Mukarrab, along with my guest, Mr. Ehrar Ramispour, a scholar of Islamic and human rights law, will explore this topic in depth. My guest has taught for many years at the Faculty of Sharia at Kabul University in Afghanistan. He has also served for over a decade and a half in the Human Rights Service of the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan. He is the author of several books and articles in the fields of law and human rights. He is actively involved in civil society, peace building, and human rights work through various institutions in Afghanistan and the region. He currently serves as the president of World Anti-Extremism Network and is affiliated fellow at the Raoul Wallenberg Institute for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law at the Lund University of Sweden. Mr. Ehrar Ramispour, welcome to the program. Let me begin with the first question. When was Islamic political jurisprudence first introduced, and what are its core elements?
Thank you, Ms. Rajab, for having me. Hello to all the distinguished listeners. It's a pleasure to be here. First, I would like to briefly clarify the term Islamic jurisprudence, known as fiqh in Arabic, as well as the concept of Islamic political jurisprudence. I have to say that Islamic fiqh, which initially covered both the practical and theological provisions of Islamic Sharia, has a longer history compared to Islamic political jurisprudence, which was discussed by some Islamic scholars in the 10th century. One of the earliest Islamic scholars who started writing in Islamic governance, not Islamic political jurisprudence, Islamic governance, was Imam Abu Yusuf. Imam Abu Yusuf was close student of Imam Abu Hanifa, the founder of Hanafi school of thought. He was living between 731 to 798. Who wrote a book about the administration of financial affairs of the Islamic Caliphate. He wrote that book for Harun al-Rashid. Harun al-Rashid, as we all know, he was a well-known Umayyad caliph. The book of Al-Kharaj, which is the name in the title of his book, played a very significant role in collecting taxes, in organizing financial affairs, and also governing system in that era. However, I have to clarify that it was not a pure Islamic jurisprudence literature, since it was focusing only on the financial affairs of the state. Later, another scholar, Islamic scholar, he was the actual scholar who started writing in Islamic political jurisprudence. His name was Abul Hasan Ali al-Mawardi. He was living in the 10th century. And also, similar to him, there was another scholar by the name of Qazi Abu Yala, who lived in the same era and also in the same city somehow. And both of them wrote their books with similar names, Al-Ahkam Sultaniya or Al-Ahkam As-Sultaniya. The laws of Islamic governance, meaning of this book was the governing or the Islamic provisions for the governance. These books, Al-Ahkam Sultaniya, both Ahkam Sultaniya books, known as reliable books, highly trusted books in the field of political jurisprudence or Islamic governance system. Among the later Islamic scholars, after Al-Mawardi and Qazi Abu Ya'la, Ibn Taymiyyah is another Islamic scholar in 13th century, can be considered one of the scholars who wrote a book on this topic under the name of As-Siyasat As-Shara'iyya, the politics of Sharia. After Ibn Taymiyyah, you can see some other scholars like Islamic political jurisprudence or the system of governance in Islam has been one of the intellectual debates and concern among these scholars, which started in the recent centuries. Once again, with Sayyid Jamaluddin al-Afghani, a very well-known scholar who was living in 19th century, 1838 to 1897, followed by his students in Egypt. Probably our audiences, they are familiar with the name of Shaykh Muhammad Abduhu, who was a close student of Sayyid Jamaluddin. And also later on by Sayyid Qutb, who was the founder of the Brotherhood movement in Egypt. And somehow their opinions in their literatures resulted in the emergence of the Muslim Brotherhood movements in Egypt and some Islamic countries, including Afghanistan. In the 20th century, the peak of political thinking in Islam linked back to the thoughts of Maulana Abul Ala Maududi. He is known as the founder of Jamiat-e-Islami Pakistan. Maududi introduced Islamic ideology as superior to capitalism and communism. According to Maududi, the Islamic State is a democratic caliphate or a religious democracy because the people must elect its leader and should not be governed by scholars or jurists alone. Moreover, laws and governance in such a government are established in light of the Quran and Sunnah. These people, these scholars, were the initial scholars. They started talking and discussing the Islamic political jurisprudence. In recent years, numerous books and articles have been authored by other Islamic scholars exploring the Islamic governance system. However, the perspectives presented in these works have often lacked particular applicability in Islamic societies. We never seen any practical approach or practical modality of what was written by these scholars in their books. Notable examples include Nizam al-Hukmi fil Islam. This is another book written by a Jordanian scholar, Muhammad al-Khalidi, in 1946. And also Fiqh al-Dawla, or Jurisprudence of Governing in Islam, written by Shaykh Yusuf al-Kardawi, who is a very well-known scholar in the Arab world and also in Afghanistan, in most of the Islamic societies. His book is titled Kitab al-Dini wa al-Dawla. And also The Implementation of Sharia. This is another book written by another scholar, contemporary scholar. His name is Abid al-Jabiri. The views of these Islamic scholars about Islamic governance from the previous centuries to the present era have only been found in books, to be honest. Articles and also or political agendas. If you see some agendas of some political Islamic radical political movements, you only can see these ideas and ideologies there. And also its practical model has never been implemented in any specific area of any Islamic country in the world. Almost all books written about the system of governance or Islamic political jurisprudence are similar in their subject and content. The main elements of the Islamic governing system, which are described in all these books somehow, in one or another way, it is starting from the head of the state, which they called Amir or Caliph, head of state in our modern terminology. Islamic Council, this is another part, another element of the political jurisprudence of Islam, which comprised or consists of a group of Islamic ulema or Islamic scholars. They are going to discuss and consult on different affairs of the governing system based on the light of the Sharia, or Sharia's resources like Quran and Qiyas and Ijma and Sunnah and other sources. The third element of the Islamic political governing system is Sharia laws, which they call the implementation of Sharia provisions, Sharia rules, Sharia orders. There are certain principles, certain references, books, and also explanation about how to use Sharia, how to implement provisions of Sharia. The fourth part of the governing system of Islamic political system is to have an independent judiciary system. The judiciary always has a very high stage in the governing system of Islamic political jurisprudence. And another important part of the Islamic governing system is a solid military forces, because they're always promoting the concept of jihad, and for that purpose, they want to have strong military forces, jihadi commanders, jihadi force, to be ready for deployment in any part of the Islamic soil and to expand the territory and the ideology of Islam to other parts of the world. Another component of the Islamic jurisprudence is another institution they called the Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. This institution comprised of a number of individuals, including scholars, to promote virtue in the society and to prevent sin. They are a group of people like the similar to a little bit to judiciary and similar to police, as we have seen in some Islamic state, even in recent years, in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, in other parts, and right now in Afghanistan. These are the main components of Islamic jurisprudence, and it was a brief history of those scholars. They started initially their writings and their literatures on Islamic jurisprudence, political jurisprudence.
Thank you so much for shedding light on the historical origins. Now that we understand its foundation, let's explore its interaction with the modern world. My next question is, are the key elements of Islamic political jurisprudence, such as the concept of the Amir leader, Bayah allegiance, Shura consultation, Amar bil Maruf wa Nahi Anil Munkar, which is promoting vice and preventing sin, Sharia-based orders and restriction on women's participation in governance and public life compatible with democratic systems?
Let's start from this point that the scholars of Islamic political jurisprudence consider the religion of Islam to be a mixture of religious, legal, political, social, economic, and cultural rulings. They believe on this, which can be regulate all the affairs of human life and society. While democracy, if we look deeply, is purely human initiated system that preserves freedom and fundamental rights based on representation system and rule of law. This is the key points we always should consider. In one hand, we have the thought and belief of Islam and Islamic scholars that they are saying it is sufficient. Islam, Islamic Sharia, Islamic political system, it is sufficient and it can cover all aspects of human beings' lives. In the opposite side, we have a democratic system. The democratic system, it is human initiated or human invented ideas or system that organize the living system in all affairs in relation between human and between the state, between citizens. And there are certain issues indeed we all know about how a democratic system functions. Unfortunately, there are several points of contradiction between Islamic political jurisprudence and democracy. Let's take a closer look. In Islamic political jurisprudence, the Amir or head of a state is typically a religious figure. This is 100% clarified in all Islamic sources that there should be Islamic scholar who should lead the Islamic society as Amir or Caliph. Indeed, if you look deeply to the history, to the Umayyad, to the Abbasid era, most of them, they were not Islamic scholars. In practical, as I mentioned earlier, it is not something that we 100% say that it's practiced during the time. No. The examples we have from those eras, it shows that most of these caliphs, they were not Islamic scholars. They were just ordinary citizens. They just use all their possible ways to reach to power. This is very important issue. And also, we have to say that this religious figure should be selected by a group of Islamic scholars. This is an Islamic jurisprudence, political jurisprudence. These Islamic scholars, we call them members of council, Islamic council. They are choosing or selecting one of them as their Amir, and that guy should run the state or should lead the Muslim community in accordance with Islamic Sharia. These scholars are considered the only legitimate authority to choose the leader, the Council of Ulema, without granting ordinary citizens any rule in the selection process. There is no rule like other democratic system in modern societies, no rule for ordinary citizens to take part on this selection process. There is no electoral system, unfortunately. There are specific conditions outlined in Islamic fiqh for assuming this high position, but I won't go into these details at this time. It already described in many books, and our audiences can open those Islamic jurisprudence books in literatures, and they should easily understand that there are certain conditions for that. One of the conditions for the leadership of Islamic society, like to be Amir or being an Amir, is that that guy should be man, not woman. That is one of the conditions, which is contradicting fully to the human rights values in our contemporary time. And also, this is totally against the importance rule of citizens in choosing the head of their state in a democratic system, in the principle of representation. This is indeed a very strong principle of a democratic system that everyone should represent in the system through the parliament, through direct participation in the election, or indirect representation by electing their representative to their parliaments. The shura in Islamic political jurisprudence, shura means council, like parliament we have in our modern democracies, does not reflect a modern parliamentary system, as it consists of a group of selected Islamic scholars known as the Ahle Hal wal Akt. This is the term, but the terminology of Islamic jurisprudence, it has a number of terms. One of that is the Council of Ahle Hal in Akt. This is a kind of qualification of those Islamic scholars or jihadi, including some jihadi commanders, to sit in that council and take decisions. These scholars have the right to consult and deliberate on issues, but their decisions are not binding. Ultimately, the Amir holds full authority to accept or reject their recommendations. He is only expected to support decisions that align with Sharia. Concepts like majority and minority opinion do not hold significance in this council system. In the democratic system, we always respect the ideas, the opinions, and the votes of majority and also the minority somehow. The majority's ideas and opinions and suggestions accepting in the council, in the parliaments. But in the Islamic system, even if there are majority people voting for some issue, that issue will not be accepted by Sharia. It will not be applicable because Amir will take the final decision. He will identify, is it compatible with Islamic Sharia or not? Unfortunately, all Islamic political jurists from Al-Mawardi to Ibn Taymiyyah, all of them, rejected women's participation. This is another key factor, unfortunately, in the Islamic jurisprudence system. There is no rule for women to participate in any decision-making important or key events in this kind of governing system.
You have explained it very well, sir. Let me ask another question, and that is, why has Islamic political jurisprudence remained in the past and it failed to develop or evolve?
It is a very important question, and always this question was asking in different occasions for me. It's very important. One of the aspects is the closure of ijtihad. Ijtihad means extracting or discovering new rules and provisions from the main sources of Islamic Sharia. This closure of ijtihad happened in 13th century when the Mongols were attacking the center of the caliphate in Baghdad. And most of the Islamic scholars at the time, they agreed that we should stop any more extracting or taking out more provisions from the main sources of Islamic law. It caused for stacking the Islamic jurisprudence, including political jurisprudence and other jurisprudential issues in Islamic fiqh in the past, unfortunately. This is one of the key issues. And there is a very important principle in Islamic jurisprudence. Says that changing of ijtihad-based provisions is not avoidable by the change of time and situation. This is a very important principle, but unfortunately, no one is respecting this principle. It means that by passing the time, by the new conditions and situations, emerging new conditions situations, the provisions, ijtihad-based provisions should be changed, should be developed. This is a very progressive approach of Islamic Sharia originally, initially, but unfortunately it's stuck in the past. This is one of the reasons. And the second issue is those radical groups, they are following the classic type of Islamic jurisprudence. They never want any development on this topic, unfortunately. All radical groups supporting the ancient or classical type ideas of Islamic jurisprudence, Amir, the no participation of women, Islamic council, and this type of dictatorship phenomenon, unfortunately. These are the key issues.
And yes, this stagnation, it poses challenges, especially in the world where ideas and systems are rapidly transforming. So the question arises, can Islamic legal sources be reconciled with modern human values such as human rights and women participation, civil law, and representative political systems?
I personally believe that there are many irreconcilable points between Islamic law and critical issues such as women's participation, civil law or statutory law, and representative political system. In practices, many Islamic countries follow forms of governance that tolerate to incorporate democratic principles, from Pakistan to Indonesia, in Egypt, Tunisia, and many other Islamic countries. These states have constitutions, parliaments, elections, and commitments to international human rights law, even while remaining bound to Islamic law. There are many examples. Yeah, why not?
Yes, while debates around compatibility continue, another aspect that often captures public attention is the role of radical groups claiming to act under Islamic principles. We see and hear about the actions of extremist and radical Islamic groups in different parts of the world through the media. Are there differences in the ideologies and the practices of these groups, or do they all follow a common mindset?
In my opinion, unfortunately, most Islamic groups, I'm talking on radical groups, follow a similar ideology, though some adhere to it more strictly than others. For example, I don't see significant differences between the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and Hizb ut-Tahrir. as all of them promote similar key components of an Islamic regime or system. However, some have chosen extremely harsh and violent methods, like Daesh, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, while others, such as Hizbul Tahrir, which is a very well-known and famous party in the Central Asian countries and Middle East, are attempting to reach power through political and religious campaigns rather than armed struggles.
In your view, how can Islamic political thought be reformed in the modern era? What role do think tanks, academic and research institutions, media and civil society organizations play in this process?
I think that the justification for using violence and insisting on outdated political jurisprudence concepts such as those discussed in Al-Mawardi writings and later echoed by other scholars no longer holds in today's world. The global context has significantly changed. Muslims now live across the world, and there are complex and diverse relationships between states, communities, and nations. These realities should promote Islamic scholars, civil society actors, and researchers to revisit and critically engage with these traditional thoughts and traditional ideas, and to work toward interpretations that are more aligned with the principles of coexistence, human dignity, tolerance, mutual respect in a globalized society. In my opinion, all these institutions, from civil society to social media to academic institutions, Islamic scholars, human rights defenders, all of them have responsibility to rethink about this critical topic of Islamic political jurisprudence, to launch dialogues, discourses, and to find proper way based on Islamic Sharia provisions, a moderate way to support human communities in the Islamic world.
Thank you, Mr. Ramispur, for your thoughtful and enlightening insights. Today's discussion has helped us understand not only the historical and ideological roots of Islamic political jurisprudence, but also the need to revisit and reinterpret these traditions in the light of modern human values. And as we move forward, it is essential that reform-minded scholars, institutions, and civil society work together to promote inclusive, rights-respecting, and forward-looking interpretations of political thought in the Islamic world. Only then we can hope to build systems that truly serve justice, dignity, and peace for all. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. Be sure to follow Wayne for more critical discussions on extremism, governance, and human rights. Until next time, stay safe, stay informed.